Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good evening, everyone. Okay, we have been studying the Chula Sihanada Sutta. This is the shorter discourse on the lion's roar, Sutta number 11 in the Majjhima Nikaya. And I ended the presentation last week with the section on the two types of view. This would be on from page 160, going on to page 161, dealing with the two views, the view of being, the view of existence, and the view of non-being. And the Buddha says that any recluses or Brahmins who do not understand as they actually are the origin, disappearance, gratification, danger, and escape in regard to these two types of views, are not freed from birth, aging, and death, and so on, not freed from suffering, and those recluses and Brahmins who understand the origin, disappearance, gratification, danger, and escape in regard to these two types of views become freed from birth, aging, and death. To clarify the nature of these two types of views, I want to take a little detour and take a look at a small text from a small collection of suttas in the Pali Canon. This collection is called the Itivuttaka, and the sutta that I want to look at is sutta number 49. This is called, well, it's given the title, Held by Views. There was a handout, photocopied handout. And the Itivuttaka is a very nice collection of texts, which I highly recommend. It's published by the Buddhist Publication Society, together with another very lovely collection of small texts called the Udana, together in one volume, available in the United States from pariyatti.com by mail order. That's a word from the sponsor. Okay, to find out what these two views, what is entailed by these two types of views, we can look at this text. Begins on the bottom of page 184. The Buddha says, held by two kinds of views, some devas and human beings hold back and some overreach. The word hold back, Oliyanti, could actually mean also stick fast, get stuck, lag behind. And the word translated overreach can also mean go too far. And then only those with vision or with insight see. Okay. On to the next page. And how, bhikkhus, do some hold back? Or do some get stuck or stick fast? Okay, this is going to be concerned with the view of being, the view of existence. Devas, that is the deities, and human beings enjoy being, enjoy existence, delight in existence, are satisfied with existence. Or I would say better, rejoice in existence. Bhava Rama, Bhava Ratta, Bhava Samudita. So, people, for the most part, they enjoy existing in one form or another, going on from one state of existence after another. So one always likes to be something, and so when this life comes to an end, then one goes on to become something else. One wants to go on to some superior state. If one believes in rebirth and one wants to go on, one imagines that one will always be a king, a queen, a prince, a princess, if one comes back to the human realm, a millionaire, a millionairess, or one will become a deity. Though it always doesn't always work out that way, usually it doesn't. Okay, when the Dhamma is taught to them for bhava nirodha, for the cessation of existence, that is, for the giving up of all these conditioned states of existence, then their minds do not enter into it or acquire confidence in it or settle down upon it or become resolved upon it. Thus, bhikkhus, do some hold back. Okay, now here in this passage, this enjoying existence, delighting in existence, is actually, we could say that this is bhava tanha, the craving for existence. But on the basis of this craving for existence, people usually more intellectually inclined people fashion bhava ditti, that is, a view of existence, some kind of view that will ascribe eternal existence, everlasting existence of some type to what they consider to be their self, their soul, their spirit. And so in this way they can have the satisfaction of knowing that they will go on existing in some form or another forever. And so that view of existence then becomes a way of gratifying the craving for existence. And it gives a kind of reinforcement to the craving for existence. It gives an intellectual expression to the craving for existence. And then usually it's the intellectuals or the thinkers who give some kind of conceptual formulation to this idea of eternal existence. But then most people, at least in earlier times, would buy the idea of eternal existence. Because people, for the most part, want to go on existing forever and ever and ever. Nowadays, I think people want to get as much pleasure in this life as they can. At least this is the way it was. And so the idea of eternal existence, especially from the very moralistic religions, you have to restrain yourself, give up the enjoyment in this life, hold back so you can have eternal existence ever afterwards. So, no, I don't want that. I want to enjoy myself now. So then, to heck with the idea of eternal existence. Let me get it all now. And then when I die, I don't care what happens. But then when they get old and they start thinking and say, they start thinking, now I can't enjoy life so much anymore. Maybe I should go back and accept the idea of eternal existence. Repent the follies of my youth. Then I can have my cake. What is it? Eat my cake and have it also. Okay, then there are some who overreach or go too far, or you say overshoot the mark, we might say. Okay, there are some, see, not many. Now the Buddha is speaking in 400-something B.C., 500-something B.C. So most people accept the belief in the Atman, the self that goes on from life to life. But there are some thinkers who are troubled, ashamed, disgusted by existence. And they rejoice in non-existence. In Vibhava, asserting, this is what they assert, this is Vibhava Ditti. You see, they have this disgust with existence, and that, you could say, is an expression of Vibhava Tanha, the craving for non, that gives rise to Vibhava Tanha, the craving for non-existence. Then from that craving for non-existence, there comes this view, which is Vibhava Ditti, the view of non-existence. Inasmuch as the self, when the body perishes at death, inasmuch as the self is annihilated and destroyed, and is destroyed and does not exist after death, this is peaceful, this is excellent, this is reality. Thus, bhikkhus, some overreach, some go too far. I have to admit, I find a little strange expression, this is reality. It might just mean simply just, this is so, this is the way it is. But they find this idea of the self as something that has temporary existence, but then with the perishing of the body at death, that self is annihilated. And there's no existence beyond the death of the body. That is what they like, what they approve of. And they think that this is sort of the state of eternal peace they take quite literally when somebody dies, everybody says rest in peace. And so they say when everybody dies, they all rest in peace. That is excellent. Okay, but the third alternative, this is the Buddha's understanding, that those with vision see, those with insight, correctly understand. And how is it that they see? Here, a bhikkhu sees what has come to be as having come to be. So he sees whatever has arisen through conditions as having arisen through conditions. And having seen it thus, he practices the way for turning away, that's for disenchantment, nibbida, for dispassion, viraga, and for the cessation, nirodha, of what has come to be. That is how those with vision see. So this little, very short paragraph expresses actually dependent origination and the cessation of dependent origination. I'll just ask briefly, if I don't want to go off onto a long discussion on this, but if there's any questions on this before I come back into the sutta, the main sutta. Yeah.
In each case, they talk about cessation. In the nihilism, cessation of nothingness.
That's the way the annihilationist understands it.
But in the Buddha describes it as cessation into nirvana.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Any further questions? Okay, then let us go back into the shorter discourse on the lion's roar. Picking up on paragraph 9, this is on the four kinds of clinging, the four types of upadana. Okay, we've met these four kinds of clinging before. So here the Buddha enumerates them. What are these four types of clinging? Clinging to sensual pleasures, to any of the pleasures of the senses. Clinging to views, that is to any kind of speculative views, philosophical views, including these views of existence and non-existence, being and non-being. Then clinging to what's called silabhatta, clinging to rules and observances. And clinging to a doctrine of self. Now, clinging to rules and observances is actually clinging to rules and observances in the belief that it's especially targeted against the beliefs of Brahmins and certain ascetic groups contemporary with the Buddha, that by following particular prescribed rituals, prescribed modes of conduct, one can gain purification and liberation. The idea that by bathing in sacred rivers, one could be purified, by following certain ascetic practices, such as fasting over long periods. Subjecting the body to certain types of penances, one can be purified. But one could also see this more broadly as a kind of psychological tendency that adheres very strictly to certain... It's not saying that one should do away with rules of conduct and right rules of behavior, but by kind of adherence to the view that rigidly following certain rules, observances, that this alone is sufficient for gaining enlightenment, gaining liberation. And it is itself a view. So it, in a broad sense, it belongs to clinging to views, but because of its importance, the Buddha has singled it out and set it up in its own right as a separate type of clinging. And then the last one, clinging to a doctrine of self, includes all types of conceptually formulated views of a self, includes, in terms of the Buddha's own period, the various 60-something views of a self elaborated in the Brahmajala Sutta, and then what underlies those views of a self are the 20 types of Sakkaya Ditti, the 20 types of identity view, which we find also in the Majjhima Nikaya in Sutta number 44. So even though clinging to a doctrine of self, again, it's a clinging to views, but these views of self are so important that the Buddha has taken them out and made them a separate type of clinging. Okay, now paragraph 10 is going to... With paragraph 10, we're going to begin a quite interesting process of narrowing down these types of clinging to find out which types the followers of the other schools of thought also reject along with the Buddha, and which type of clinging is uniquely rejected by the Buddha's teaching. And so, starting in paragraph 10, the Buddha says, there are certain recluses and Brahmins who claim to propound the full understanding of all kinds of clinging, but they do not completely describe the full understanding of all kinds of clinging. Now, the commentary makes an interesting remark here. This is useful for students of Pali as well. There's a word which is translated here, full understanding.
The word is parinya. And the commentary glosses it with another word. Samatti kamma,
which means overcoming or transcending. And so to fully understand a particular type of clinging implies that one transcends it, that one overcomes it, that one goes beyond it. Okay, so now the Buddha says this is where they're incomplete. Their teaching is incomplete. They describe the full understanding of clinging to sensual pleasures without describing the full understanding of clinging to views, clinging to rules and observances, and clinging to a doctrine of self. So we have some spiritual teachers who might be well aware of the shortcomings, the faults in sensual pleasures, and so they teach a doctrine of renunciation, maybe a teaching of ascetic practices, meditation, but still they haven't overcome clinging to rules and observances. They still have some clinging to views of existence. I think they would lean to views of existence rather than non-existence, but I'm not sure. And they still have some clinging to a doctrine of self. So why is this? The Buddha asks, the reason is that these good recluses and Brahmins do not understand these three types of clinging as they really are. Therefore, even though they claim to expound the full understanding of all kinds of clinging, they describe only the full understanding of clinging to sensual pleasures, but they don't describe the full understanding of clinging to views, clinging to rules and observances, and clinging to a doctrine of self. So these teachers, you could say that they succeed in one respect, but they fall short in three respects. Okay, the next type, we have some ascetics and Brahmins who claim to propound the full understanding of all types of clinging, and they describe the full understanding of clinging to sensual pleasures and clinging to views. Okay, so they see that sensual pleasures are a hindrance, an obstacle to the spiritual life. And they see also that, they say, holding views is an obstacle to the spiritual life. So they say, give up views, don't become attached to opinions, give up all of one's ideas, conceptions about the known, Don't put up any kinds of conceptual screens between yourself and reality. Just know reality as it is. But still they will have certain rules on Thursdays. You have to go bathing 3 times, one time in the morning, one time early afternoon, one time in the evening. On Sundays, you have to circumambulate such and such a tree 7 times, but don't have any views. And if you give up all of your sensual attachments, give up your views, and you fulfill all of these rules and observances perfectly, your self will be emancipated and merge into the everlasting Brahman, the world spirit, and will abide forever. Unchanging. And so though they say give up all clinging to views, but they're still clinging to a doctrine of self. So why is that? They do not understand two types of clinging. And therefore they describe only the full understanding of clinging to sensual pleasures and clinging to views, but do not describe the full understanding of clinging to rules and observances and clinging to a doctrine of self. Okay, then there are certain ascetics and Brahmins who claim to expound the full understanding of all kinds of clinging. They describe the full understanding of clinging. Okay, I'm sorry. So the second type of ascetics mentioned in paragraph 11, we could say that they have given up two types of clinging, but they still adhere to two types of clinging. Now we come to the third type of ascetic. Okay, they claim to expound the full understanding of all types of clinging, and they describe the full understanding of clinging to sensual pleasures. Okay, they say to gain liberation, one has to become free from sensual attachment, from sensual desire. They say one has to give up the clinging to views. And they even say one has to give up the clinging to rules and observances. But they do not describe the full understanding of clinging to a doctrine of self. So this type of ascetic, this type of teacher, we could say has a very deep understanding of the danger in clinging. And we could say that they've advanced very far spiritually. Many of them might have gained very high states of samadhi, even high states of jnana, of wisdom or understanding, because they know that one has to get free from views, free from even some of the Brahminic ascetics. When they reach certain stages of realization, they see that the rules and observances laid down by the Vedas, which all of the Brahmins observe as very holy and sacred, they see are no longer binding upon themselves. These are the sannyasis in the last stages of realization according to the scheme of the Upanishads. They can wander about. They're completely beyond all of the rules and regulations of Brahminic law. But still, they have this conviction, this very deep conviction of the reality of an eternal, everlasting, substantial self. And so they describe three types of clinging, but the one type of clinging they don't describe is this clinging to a doctrine of self, clinging to a view of self. And so the Buddha, paragraph 13, he makes a statement that might seem rather hard. Sometimes it might seem rather narrow-minded, parochial, maybe biased, because it's not very liberal, accommodating. We should all say everybody should have an equal claim to truth. Why should one person say his view of truth is more genuine than that of anybody else? But the Buddha says, in such a Dhamma and discipline as that, it is plain that confidence in the teacher is not rightly directed, that confidence in the Dhamma is not rightly directed. Just want to get the Pali words here. That fulfillment of the precepts is not rightly directed, and that the affection among the companions in the religious life in the Dhamma is not rightly directed. I have to admit, when I first read this, I had some resistance to this and thought, he shouldn't say that. Because there are certain teachers, like outside teachers, whose ideas I thought were worthy of respect and still do. Though one would have to say that in the final analysis, their doctrines, their views, would not be leading to ultimate and final liberation. And so here the Buddha, in the next sentence, he gives the reason himself. Why is that? Because that is how it is when the Dhamma and discipline is badly proclaimed, or maybe wrongly proclaimed and wrongly expounded. It doesn't mean that it's completely bad, completely badly proclaimed, badly expounded. Within that Dhamma and discipline, we could say that there are many good things, because such a teaching will no doubt proclaim many good points in the sphere of morality. Moral discipline will be correct. They'll teach many points of wise training in the domain of renunciation, self-purification, leading to samadhi, even some teachings concerning the preparatory stages of wisdom, getting rid of views, not clinging to rules and observances. But to reach the final, well, correct, sharp and precise right view, it is necessary to have the right view of selflessness and the right view of conditionality, dependent origination. And as long as there is the view of self or Atman, as long as there is the view of, as long as there is a view of the self, then that will obstruct the view of selflessness, of non-self. It will obstruct the view of conditionality, dependent origination. And so, such a Dhamma and discipline would be unemancipating, anijanaka, not conducive to upasama, to final peace. And it is expounded by one who is not fully enlightened. Okay, the next two paragraphs are now going to state the situation in the Buddha's teaching. And again, if we look at these two paragraphs superficially, it seems almost as if the Buddha is boasting, saying, my teaching, everything is excellent and perfect. But we have to realize the Buddha is one who has completely overcome the sense of self, and so he could just state the way it is, exactly as it is within his own teaching, not putting forward his own teaching in order to score points against the teachings of others, but in order to make clear what are the precise precise lines, the precise outlines of a teaching that leads to final liberation. So he says, when a Tathagata, an accomplished one, a fully enlightened one, claims to expound the full understanding of all kinds of clinging, he completely describes the full understanding of all kinds of clinging. He describes the full understanding of clinging to sensual pleasures, clinging to views, clinging to rules and observances, and clinging to a doctrine of self. Okay, so now the Buddha gets in all four types of clinging. And especially here, the key point, since the Buddha describes the first three types of clinging, we could say in common with the other teachers, but actually one would say that he takes the other three types of clinging even in a deeper and wider way than the other teachers. But what is especially unique to the Buddha's teaching is this focusing upon the clinging to a doctrine of self. And that is because it's in the Buddha's teaching that the doctrine or teaching of anatta, the teaching of selflessness, is the kind of unique and crown jewel of the whole structure of the teaching. So in paragraph 15, the Buddha can then say, in such a Dhamma and discipline as this, it is plain that confidence in the teacher is rightly directed, that confidence in the Dhamma is rightly directed, that the fulfillment of the precepts is rightly directed, and that the affection among companions in the Dhamma is rightly directed. Why is that? Because that is how it is when the Dhamma and discipline is well proclaimed and well expounded, emancipating, conducive to peace, expounded by one who is fully enlightened. And if you remember, these four points that are mentioned here in paragraph, actually in the two paragraphs, 13 and 15, these take us back to one of the paragraphs at the opening of the sutta, where the Buddhist monks and the wanderers of other sects meet in this imaginary dialogue, and both of them claim to have confidence in their teacher, in their doctrine, both claim to have fulfilled the precepts, and both claim that there are friendly relations among their co-religionists. And so the wanderers of other sects are saying, what is the difference between us? And so now the Buddha has, through this rather meandering or apparently wandering or meandering analysis, he's brought the discussion here to the climax, to its crucial point, that there is a critical distinction between the outside wanderers and the Buddha's followers, on the basis of which the Buddha's followers can claim to have rightly directed confidence in the teacher and their doctrine, to have right fulfillment of the precepts, and to have true harmonious affection amongst co-religionists. Whereas that is not perfectly the case with the outside followers. And I think we have to remember this is being spoken at a time, perhaps when the Buddha's teaching maybe was at its a high point in its development. But if you look in the Vinaya Pitaka, you'll see quarrels between groups of monks. The Buddha has to come in and resolve these quarrels, sometimes unsuccessfully. Sometimes the behavior of the monks is outrageous, and the Buddha has to lay down rule after rule after rule, sometimes unsuccessfully. So don't take it that this paragraph means that the Buddha's teaching is absolutely perfect in its historical and social dimension. Okay, now from this point we're going to see an interesting sort of development of the teaching. Now that the Buddha has resolved this issue out of which the sutta originally began, he's going to take up these four types of clinging and use that as a starting point for another issue, and that is to show how to trace from those four types of clinging, to trace them to their source, and then to show how, based on the elimination of these four types of clinging, a monk frees the mind from all types of clinging and achieves the final goal of the spiritual life, attaining arhantship or nirvana, and then can roar the true lion's roar of liberation from birth and death. So, he says, these four kinds of clinging, what do they have as their source? What is their origin? From what are they born and produced? So these four kinds of clinging have craving as their source. Here we're now going back in the chain of dependent origination, which we treated in the last sutta, the Samaditti Sutta, in detail. The four kinds of clinging have craving as their source. Craving has feeling as its source. Feeling has contact as its source. Contact has the six sense bases as its source. The six sense bases originate from nama-rupa, name and form. Name and form, nama-rupa, originates from consciousness. Consciousness originates from the volitional formations. The volitional formations originate from ignorance. Okay, here with this, the Buddha has shown even most deeply that he has understood not only the four kinds of clinging, but he has shown through the process of dependent origination that he understands from one condition to another how these four types of clinging ultimately originate, that they ultimately originate from ignorance. And now he's going to show how a disciple of his is capable of eliminating that ignorance. So when ignorance is abandoned and true knowledge has arisen in a monk, then with the fading away of ignorance and the arising of true knowledge, he no longer clings to sensual pleasures, no longer clings to views, no longer clings to rules and observances, no longer clings to a doctrine of self. So with this, the Buddha shows that for his followers, this overcoming, this full understanding of clinging is not just a theoretical full understanding, but it is actually an overcoming of the four types of clinging, an overcoming that occurs through the generating of this true knowledge, this vijja, that eliminates avijja, ignorance. Okay, so by generating this true knowledge, ignorance fades away. And when ignorance fades away, craving falls away. And craving is the condition for clinging. And when clinging falls away, then one no longer clings to any of these four objects of clinging. Okay, when he does not cling, he is not agitated. Actually, there's a... wordplay here. Okay, he is not agitated. When he is not agitated, he personally attains nibbana. Okay, this word that's translated, he is not agitated, is naparitasati. Naparitasati, which means, literally, he does not thirst. And that verb naparitasati is, it's hard to see this in Pali. This is the verb from which the noun tanha, meaning craving, is derived. I put the Sanskrit along with the Pali because you could see the word connections more evidently in the Sanskrit than in the Pali. Because in Pali, the root tas gives the verb paritasati and the noun tanha. But in tanha, the S doesn't appear, so the connection is a little obscure. But in the Sanskrit, you go from Trish to the noun Krishna, which means craving. And then from the root Trish, you get the verb paritrishyate, which would, it's what's translated here, not agitated, but literally it's one does not thirst with craving. The reason why it's translated agitated rather than one does not thirst or one does not crave is because the verb paritasate sometimes takes on an additional meaning of meaning to fear, because in Pali it got mixed with another verb. So it takes on two meanings in Pali. And so I wanted to use one English rendering which would capture both senses, and agitated seemed to do. Okay, so the sense is that when one does not cling, then one does not have any thirst anymore, that thirst of craving. And when one does not thirst, then one personally attains nibbana. But there's another wordplay here, which is based upon the idea of upadana has a sense or meaning of being fuel. The word translated clinging also means fuel. And to cling, you see, one no longer clings to views, one no longer clings to rules and observances, one no longer clings to a doctrine of self. You could also translate that, one no longer burns through with sensual pleasures as fuel. One no longer burns with views as fuel. One no longer burns with rules and observances as fuel. One no longer burns with doctrine of self as fuel. Then from that sense, one moves to one personally attains nibbana, having the sense of one is personally extinguished, or one's craving is inwardly extinguished. Well, let's say one is personally quenched, in that the flames of the defilements are inwardly quenched. But this idea of the fire being quenched or extinguished came to signify or symbolize the attainment of nibbana. Okay, and then with its attainment, he understands birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done, there is no more coming back to any state of being. Okay, and this is what the Blessed One, the Buddha, said. The monks were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. Okay, and that is the shorter discourse on the lion's roar. If any questions, then please feel welcome to ask any questions, comments. David.
Yes, upon realizing the reality of non-self, would it be conventionally okay to say one has achieved self-realization?
One has a what?
Achieved self-realization. Conventionally, would it be okay to say that?
Conventionally okay to say one has achieved self-realization.
by recognizing and being aware of the doctrine of non-self.
Yeah, of course, one can say one has achieved self-realization, but as long as one understands it's not realization of a self. In Pali, too, one has the expression pachatang veditabho vinyuhi, the wise are to which realize this for themselves. Or one has to realize this ajatang. One has to realize this inwardly. What's translated inwardly is within oneself. So we could say that that's self-realization. But it's not a realization of a substantial, true, metaphysical self. Yes, George.
In the first part of the sutta, the Buddha talks about the two views of being and non-being.
Yeah.
And then he goes to discuss the four kinds of clinging.
Yeah.
Is there a relationship between the two views, being and non-being, and the four types of clinging?
Okay, is there a relationship between the two views of being and non-being and the four types of clinging? Well, certainly the views of being and non-being would fit into the clinging to views. And since view of being and view of non-being often are concerned with the existence or non-existence of a self, they would also come into, fit into the clinging to a doctrine of self. But I think that there's a shift, there's actually a kind of shift in the logic of the presentation when we move from paragraph 8 to paragraph 9. It's not just following a straight course, but here something new is introduced in paragraph 9 with the four kinds of clinging, because now the Buddha, I think, wants to this is a good point. I think I just saw something I didn't see before. Yeah, in paragraph 6, 7, 8, the Buddha is showing somewhat from one angle the difference between his own school and the other schools, by way of this view of being and the view of non-being. He's implying that the followers of all of the other systems fall into the view of being and the view of non-being, and so they don't see the origin, disappearance, gratification, danger, and escape, and so they're not view from birth, aging, and death, whereas he and his followers are. And so in that way, he's highlighting the difference in terms of their relationship to the view of being and view of non-being. But he hasn't used that to focus down upon, to use that as a way of focusing down very narrowly upon this difference and then using that as a way of highlighting the difference between his Dhamma and discipline and the other Dhammas and disciplines, the way he does in these paragraphs 14, 15, 13, 14, and 15. In fact, now looking at it, it seems to me, I'll have to check this, the comparison. Did you happen to look at the Chinese Agama counterpart? Venerable Shenjing or Venerable Guangjing, did you look just today or yesterday at the Chinese Agama counterpart? It just struck me that these paragraphs 6, 7, 8 look almost as though they could have been spliced in there this happens when you compare different versions. Sometimes you find a few paragraphs which look like they could have been spliced in. Say if it's not, if we find several Chinese Agama counterparts of this sutta, which wouldn't have those paragraphs in, that seems almost to be, and these paragraphs don't seem to be part, a necessary part of the logic of the sutta, that would be somewhat weighty grounds for conjecturing that they could have been spliced in. Of course, the sutta would just, the logic of the sutta could follow quite well if one were to jump from paragraph 5 to paragraph 9. I'll have to check Venerable Analeo's comparative study of the two versions. Any further questions?
Regarding the Bawa, Titi, and the Vita, like
yeah.
Buddha first sort of showed the latent, clear difference between their doctrine and his. So it's a sort of simple, clear distinction.
Yeah.
And then when he narrowed down to the four upadanas, he sort of said, now those look like we have this point in common. Because they say, we have that too, we have that too.
Mm.
But he sort of pulled them down to the fourth one.
Yeah.
I think that's where the difference lies. And I think it's a way of not the logic of the strategy.
Yeah. Yeah. It could be. Anyway, it would be interesting to look at several versions and see how they compare. It's just that it's just struck me now that if one goes from 5 to 9, one has a completely straight line of argumentation, and that 6, 7, and 8 are not a necessary part of that logic. Though they might have fitted in for strategic purposes. Okay, I think we have to stop now anyway. And stop with the end with the sharing of the merits. Okay, we share the merits with devas, buddhas, other beings. Akasata chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Sasanang Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Desanang Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mang parang etavata cham hehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe deva anumodantu Sabba sampati siddhya etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang Sabbe satta anumodantu sabba sampatti siddhya. I think next week we go to the Alagadupama Sutta, that's number 22.